Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Late bloomers tend to have more curiosity. They tend to have more resilience.
There are stories and mythology that this country has woven around Black men.
This is the cavalry, right? These are the leaders, the hometown heroes and local leaders. And we are.
It's a survival mechanism to just be like wary of the police.
What if everything we've been taught is just all wrong?
What's worth more than this fear right now?
And that rising after failure is part of the glory of being a human being.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Hi, this is Ryan Fraser.
This is Troy Daly.
This is Gus Boyett.
This is Don Hutchison.
This is Jürgen Klopp, and you're listening to The Big Interview with Graham Hunter.
Thank you, Jürgen. I travel to all these interviews from Barcelona, and our socios, our beloved members, keep us on the road. This independent podcast wouldn't happen without them. Please go to patreon.com/Graham Hunter right now to join us, to become a socio, and to get every interview we produce without adverts and before it goes out on the main feed, plus lots of bonus content, including the chance to put questions to our guests and to me via the monthly Q&A. You will also get bonus content every month, including the audio versions of my regular columns for ESPN. So do please go to patreon.com/Graham Hunter and join the club and get your family and friends to do so. Maybe even strangers in the street. Love you. Hello there. Being that this is the second part of our Alan Rambo McAnally big interview, we've called this part two. We focus on his time at Bayern Munich, which was cut short by the injury which effectively ended Al's career. He was in sensational form when he moved to Bavaria, but he proves to be a really good witness to life, routines, ideas, personalities at one of the biggest, greatest, most successful clubs in European history. Here's the story of what it's like to walk off the Hampden Park pitch after playing for Scotland and straight into a room where Uli Hoeneß and Jupp Heynckes tell you that they want you to play for Bayern. Not a bad day by anybody's standards. In the Bundesliga, Alan played with and was coached by some legendary footballers and one who'd become a treble-winning coach, Hansi Flick, with whom he was particularly friendly. In the wake of Scotland's first tournament qualification since 1998 for France, and that wonderful draw, hello David Marshall, against Serbia, Big Rambo talks about what playing for his country at a World Cup felt like. This is fresh, new to everybody, but already it's a classic big interview. I can say that because I'm objective. I've got no interest here. Nothing to see, folks. Move along straight to part two of Rambo McAnally. If you enjoy it, please leave a review. If you don't enjoy it, tell me why. But if you have enjoyed the big interview, particularly this one, tell people. Share it with friends. Bring some light into people's life. That's really all I'm trying to do. And, well, listen to great people talk about football too, which is fantastic. Thanks for joining us in the big interview. Before we bridge into Bavaria, we've got people who are called socios. They're sort of members of the pod who've been with us for how many years, Alan, I can't tell you. And they're like family because they come to events, they're as keen as I am to hear guys like you talk in a relaxed way. Ian Arnott is one of the great ones, an ex, a good knock-kill motorcycle rider. And on the subject of plumbers, which we were on that subject last week when you almost lost one.
Sorry to interrupt you here, right? We're going to do this last week. And my mate, who genuinely is my plumber, did all my bathrooms, does. Listen, he always says to me, he went, "Have you got enough sugar in your bowl? Would you like me to come round and put sugar in your bowl? Because I can't even wash my own windows." Anyway, playing football, running about like a madman, because he's like, "I'll teach these young kids." Doesn't feel well. goes grey as a thing. We get a phone call, Paul's really ill, takes the hospital, has a heart attack. I'm like, what? So, of course, I text him giving it, you're at it. I've no sugar in the bowl. Telling you guys, we need to cancel because my mate's in it. And I'm like, oh, my God. Everything that's happening in the world at the moment in time, all of a sudden that drops on you and you're like, my God. Anyway, the good news is, everybody, he's absolutely fine.
Paul, stay well if you ever listen to this. And also, think about tiki-taka, Paul, mate. Just never mind the sprints. Just let the ball do the work. Ian Arnott is one of the Plumbing Brotherhood. And Ian says, could you ask Alan, what was it like to cross one of the biggest divides in world football? After playing for Ayr United, to finally come home and play for Kilmarnock, following in the footsteps of his title-winning father.
Ian, I never wanted to play for Kilmarnock for one simple reason. It was because of Dad. There was no urgency for me to say, I want to play for the same team as my father played. To be quite honest with you, my career was finished. It was over. My knee was done and dusted. And if it hadn't been for one man, I would never have even been at Kilmarnock, was the late, great Tommy Burns.
Great man.
I have had some friends in football and looked up to people in football. And had Tommy Burns not been the manager of Kilmarnock, I wouldn't have gone there to coach the kids. And I certainly wouldn't have. And obviously, I had a little bit of a break, so my knee was kind of less inflamed, and et cetera. So they went, come on, we've got a great atmosphere here. You, George McCluskey, you know, some of the young players around about us at the time. He said, come on, sign a contract for 3 months and, you know, play in a few games and, you know, we can survive. We can not go down. I'm like, TB, no. I like just, he says, come on, it'll be great in the dressing room and all that. And I'm like, fair enough. So I said, I played 6 or 7 games, didn't even score a goal. Didn't score a goal, honest to God. But in terms of the camaraderie and helping the lads during the game, I mean, I think we even got to the semi-final of the Scottish Cup. We're unlucky not to beat Rangers, actually. And I think I was on the bench with Toby and he brought us on, but I think we got beat 1-0. And for not Tommy Burns, I would never be able to say I was a Kilmarnock fan because I had no desire to be because Dad was such a hero there. But he was the reason, Ian, I went to Kilmarnock, and I am so glad that I did, just to be around him. He was that fantastic. He was a Celtic man through and through, very, very, you know, religious man, Tommy, family man. I mean, one brilliant story, and it's not a slight on Tommy, it's just the way he was. We had a Christmas party in Glasgow at Celtic, and everybody arrived at 4:30, and at 7:10, taxi for Burns. We were like that. Has he been drinking? What the hell's he been doing? What's Tommy doing? Get 7:30. When you're here for 2 hours, you're like that. What? You better get him a taxi. Big Roy, I can see Big Roy Aitken lifting him up and putting him in a taxi, sending him back to Rosemary. He was just the best. And then the following morning at training or something, he'd be like, right, let's go!
Lovely,
he was
lovely.
Just the best infectious guy you've ever met in your life. He's just a superstar, Tommy Burns.
I'm not going to the second and final part of this without... Jackie's come up twice. I wasn't old enough to see him in that Kilmarnock side. Just a snapshot of the type of player your father was. Because that achievement, that side... Okay, it was in an era where Dundee won a title, I think, 2 years before. I haven't won it since. Kilmarnock won that title. Knocked over big names in Europe and thrashed some of them. Just a snapshot of what you understand your dad was like as a footballer.
Yeah, I think he was leaner than me. I've got my thighs up. Big thighs. My dad was a bit thinner, but he was very tall, my dad, 6'2", and he would take the ball. Used to call him China legs. And he used to take the ball and just take it for a run and just go past people for fun and stuff, you know. I remember Dad telling me one of the European nights, they'd gone to Eintracht Frankfurt and got beat 3-0, I'm going to say, I can't remember now. And Dad gave the ball away at Rugby Park and it was 4-0. And he was like, oh my God, that's a great start. And then he went on, he, you know, scored 5 goals. And there was literally people on the side of the pitch. It was one of them. Like, he was telling me, he said, it was just incredible. It was brilliant, et cetera, et cetera. And even he used to get still excited and teary-eyed when he thought about it. But Dad was an inside right. So let's just say like a midfield forward player. Let's go, who would it be like? Maybe like a Bruno Fernandes nowadays, so something like that.
Wow.
A very gifted football player, Dad was. And yeah, I was fortunate to get the McAnally genes.
Everything now is about, the internet knows everything in inverted commas.
And when I grew up, football managers, there really weren't so many things called agents. Football managers used journalists to tap players up and to get the deal done ahead of times. You're at Villa, they love you. And Bayern Munich come calling. How do you find out about it at first?
I bet you were at this game. We played Chile at Hampden, Scotland. I scored, played really well, and I've got my dad with me. And I'm driving dad back down to Ayr because I'm staying at mum and dad's before I drive back. No, I was getting the train back to Birmingham. I'm driving my dad's car because he wants a whiskey. Big Jake wants a whiskey.
Fair enough.
So I'm driving back, stay at mum and dad's. He's dropping me at some like 6:30 in the morning at Glasgow Central to get to Birmingham New Street because we were training on the Thursday afternoon about 2:30, 3:00 back at Villa. And after the game, as a guy, an agent, says to me, "So you do me a favour." He said, "Look, Bayern Munich were here." He said, "They've been watching you for a month." I was like, "Oh, right, okay." He said, "Would you go and meet them?" I said, "I've got my dad with me." My dad's like, "I want a whiskey." And I'm like, "You'll get a whiskey. Don't worry about it." So I'm going to say, and it was the hotel, you'll probably remember the name of it. It wasn't the Hilton, it's the one bit the back of the Hilton that was almost underneath the flyover, right next to the flyover, big brown hotel. So I go there, and I say, "Yeah, okay, I'm not doing anything anyway." So we go in, the big man gets a whiskey, I'm sitting down, in I go, Uli Hoeneß, Jupp Heynckes, President Fitzscherer, and another one from the Presidium. Beckenbauer wasn't there, which I was kind of quite happy with, to be honest. That's all I would need. And Uli Hoeneß is like, "Hello, good evening, how are you?" And I was like, he went, "Well done tonight, that was really good." He said, "You must be really proud and all that." I said, "Yeah, yeah." And Jupp doesn't say anything. Jupp says almost nothing because his English is pretty non-existent, to be honest, back then. And I like start talking about, you know, Aston Villa. I said, "We've been watching you for a few weeks and that. And, you know, would you be interested in coming to Bayern Munich?" If he'd have given me a pen there and then, I'd have probably just signed the contract, not even knowing what I was going to get. But of course, I wanted to say, "Oh my God, yes, please." But it came out as, "Well, that would be, you know, be nice. I'm still an Aston Villa player. I'd need to speak to my football." He says, "Don't you worry about that." And I was like, "Okay." He said, "Look, we just wanted to touch base. It was an opportunity for us to come and watch you in person and meet you in person. Thanks for coming to meet us." And I'm thinking, "No problem." They're like, "Okay." I don't remember passing through Kilmarnock or even getting to the West Coast where mum and dad lived. I was such in a high after the game and then meeting somebody like Hoeneß and Heynckes, basically, who said, "Look, we'd like you to come to Bayern Munich. See you later. Be in touch." And I was like, now my dad, who's like my agent, he's like, "Oh, that'd be good. That'll be hard. That'll be tough, that. You know, that won't be like Aston Villa or Celtic, that. You know, that's..." Because dad's thinking St Etienne, Paris Saint-Germain, Atletico Madrid, Real Madrid, Milan, Bayern, you know, Borussia Mönchengladbach, all these huge European teams. This is a step up. And I'm saying, "Well, I'd go. I think I'd go." Anyway, go back to Villa Park. Thinking nobody knows. "Taylor, you in here now." I was like, it's impossible for him to know. In my head, I was like, "Right, we must be going for another farm run. What do you think you're playing at?" I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "Don't look, I already know you've spoken to them." I was like, How did you know? How did you possibly know? There was a guy called Jim Walker who was the physio who really liked me, and Jim had actually driven to Scotland, didn't even ask me for a ticket, watched the game and then drove back, and he'd obviously spoken to someone and he'd said, "Well, big man's going to meet." And I was like, that's unbelievable. You can't do anything anymore anyway. Everybody knows where you are, what your business is. And he wouldn't speak to me for 2 weeks. And I mean, he wouldn't speak to me. I'd phone the ground, "Maureen, can I speak to the gaffer?" "He won't speak to you." I'm like, fair enough. We're getting to the end of the season. And I can remember playing Coventry in the last day of the season and saying to big Brian Cocline, we used to call him Killer, right? Big Brian Cocline was the centre-half at Coventry. I said, "Look, Brian, suit big man." I said, "Look, Bayern Munich's here watching me again today. And he's like, I know. He said, don't have a problem with you. Don't have a problem with you or Big Tom, big man. Don't have a problem. I don't like that Martin Keown, though. He's getting it today. And we were like that. So Gary Thompson and I are like that. Oh, that'll do us, Brian. No problem. I don't like that Martin Keown. He's getting it today. 0-0, honestly. Worst game ever. Last day of the season. Who cares? And I thought, oh, well, that's that. Kind of done and dusted. Next thing, they'd offered $1.2 million. Graham Taylor phoned me up. He said, listen to me now. He says, A, don't let me down. He said, there is my number. If you need me at any time,
phone
my number.
Wow.
And basically went, on you go. Show them what you can do.
That's class. Don't let me down. Show them what you can do. Let me tell people what you showed them, because one of your earliest games is in the Cup. It happens to be against Eintracht Frankfurt, who your dad, you know, had knocked out of the European Cup. Very early in it, you'd know knowledge at the time, you might not know it now. I think your first goal made by Hans Flugler, you're playing against Leroy Sané's dad, Suleiman Sané, because you're playing against Nuremberg. And just let me tell, stop, Graham. Before I tell him, what did you genuinely know in that hotel meeting about the two guys in front of you? Because television wasn't deluged with continental football. There was no internet. What did you know, snapshot? Did you even immediately recognise Uli Hoeneß and Jupp Heynckes? It's all very well now, but back then, what did you know about them?
Uli looked like the player that played for Bayern. Longer, blondy hair. He was kind of immediately recognisable, but not Jupp Heynckes. I didn't know what Jupp Heynckes looked like at all.
No.
I didn't even know that Jupp Heynckes was a top international football player, revered by every single person in the whole of Germany.
Brilliant striker. Borussia Mönchengladbach played at Dodger. Brilliant striker.
Listen, I can remember we played Borussia Mönchengladbach, and nobody wanted to speak to Augenthaler, Flugler, Hansi Flick, or me. They only wanted to speak to Jupp, because he was loved there, even though he was a Bayern Munich boss. But in the very beginning, Uli Hoeneß had said, look, there's a couple of things. He says, we expect to win the title, and we will. And I'm like, okay, no pressure there then. He said, we've already won the Champions League. And I'm like, so do I. Okay, he said, and you need to learn German. I was like, right, okay. And I'm thinking, naively, does everybody not speak English in Munich? Mm. And he went, some people speak English, but a lot of people don't. This is Bavaria. This is not even part of Germany. This is a dialect here. This is Bayerisch. Anyway, I was like, okay. And every Thursday night for the first 6 months, I had a German tutor would come to the house. Should we come in and get good nabend, wie geht's dir? Können wir auf, must be auf passen, and then be careful and all that blah. And I was like, I don't know what you're saying. On my life, she goes, this is a German lesson. We will speak German, not English. I speak high English.
Whoa.
And I was like, I don't even speak. I was like, it's high English. I don't even know what high English is. And she was brilliant. And I was saying to her, I said, but if I can just stop you there a minute and say, if you just tell me what that is in German and tell me what it is in English, I'll remember it, rather than wir müssen nur Deutsch sprechen, we can only speak German, und jeden Donnerstagabend wir haben eine halbe Stunde lernen, and you know, for 1.5 hours we will learn German. I'm like, I ain't learning like that. And I swear to God, I've still got my German-English dictionary that I carry everywhere with me. And I just immersed myself into the whole shooting match. Learned German. And the only way I can say that the lads accepted me, apart from, you know, with my play on the part, was at the beginning they would say Guten Morgen or Mahlzeit, which is a rather posh way of greeting somebody. They would say, morning, big man, because they knew I spoke German. And they were like, what's that in English, Al? You know, das ist deine Sprache. What is that in your language? I mean, there was a couple of players. Hans Flugler was just a diamond guy. Huge, big guy.
He
won the World Cup. Just a mega. You know, he'd be clearing one off the line, and 4.5 seconds later, he was crossing one at the back post. And you're like, that's a physical impossibility. And Augenthaler, who was the god, Klaus Augenthaler, the god of... Yeah. I think he was the only one that did a beer advert. You know, like he did Löwenbräu or something that was made in Munich. Augie's on the top giving it that. You know, that just wouldn't happen. And he used to go, come on, Mike, let's go. We used to go to this beautiful place called Tegernsee. It was about 60, 65 kilometres out of Munich. We used to stay there before the games, all the home games. Get us away. We would train literally under at the bottom of the mountain next to a lake. It was just gorgeous. And he would say, so we'd have a meeting in the morning and he'd go, Mike, let's go. And I'd take a bread roll with me and we'd walk along the side of the... He'd light a cigarette and talk to me about the game in German, and he wanted his English to be better, and he would tell me what the team expected of me. I mean, Heynckes must have pulled Augie and said, you know, get him into line and all that jazz. And I'd feed the ducks on the way out and we'd walk the length of a cigarette, and then he'd light another cigarette and we'd walk all the way back, and I'd be like, okay, you know, thanks, Klaus, and, you know, get your German good and get this. And Augenthaler is like a god, by the way. And he's taken mega time with me. And I think even some of the other players saw it, actually, because he was a bit not aloof. Put it this way. When you're getting ready to go to training, you couldn't go onto the training pitch until Klaus was ready to go. There was a proper hierarchy. Proper.
Could I say the word regal? Did he have a regal aura about him?
Aye, very. But not only that, though, I can remember we signed Jürgen Kohler. Jürgen Kohler won the World Cup for Germany, by the way. They'd just come from Cologne. And we were just bringing in a new centre-half. And I wasn't aware of this at the time. So you'd have Beckenbauer and Heynckes and Hoeneß and Müller-Wohlfahrt, the doctor, and all the masseuses in one table, and then two tables of 10 with all the players. You could have a beer with your dinner. One beer. If you'd won a German title or you're an international football player. Brilliant, no problem. And I don't remember one player ever overstepping that mark. It was almost as though, I can't wait to win a title, or I can't wait to be an international football player, to have a beer with my dinner with Bayern Munich. And I'm talking about really good players, Kastenmeier, Jürgen Kohler, who'd just come in for big money, who still hadn't actually played for the national team. I don't remember ever seeing him have one beer at his dinner until he'd done it.
A brilliant marker, a guy who maybe would be the second of the centrals. The central next to him would be bigger, and Kohler would be like a limpet, never giving you an inch to move or think.
He'd bite his granny. I'm telling you now, he'd bite his granny. That's the kind of player he was. And then, of course, you know, the boys are getting restless. They're still, you know, get a massage on a Friday night, and Augie would hit the glass, right? And Heynckes would go, oh, yeah, right, okay. Augie's the catalyst to start the whole thing off, and then he would say, okay, Bedruhe, halb elf, you know, get your bed at 10:30. Andy that needs to see the doc now. 9 hour morgen through Frühstück, and, you know, breakfast at 9:00, and away we would go. And there was a proper, and I don't remember Andy throwing the toys at the pram there. There was players that weren't happy because they weren't playing, because there was no reserve team. There was no second team. There was 24 players and 11 people played on a Saturday. That's how difficult it was. That was something I'd struggled with at the beginning. Although, thankfully, you know, before I got injured, if I was fit, I was always in the team. And my first season was just amazing. I missed two games. One was because I got four bookings, and I think I missed the game. And the last game, we'd already won the title by 3 games to go. We played Dortmund, and Heynckes said, do you want to play? And I said, I'll play. He said, it's entirely up to you. You don't need to if you don't want to. And I said, well, play one of the young boys or something. And maybe we won 3-0. And I sat, it was a beautiful day. And we came out in the Olympic Stadium in Mercedes sports cars. They were just brilliant and brilliant days. And, you know, it's when I look back on it now, I think, well, how can a little boy for air end up at Bayern Munich?
I may tell you about another podcast. Yes, we believe in biodiversity. It's from the makers of The Big Interview, and it's called Between the Lines, the stories behind great sports writing. Every episode takes a classic sports book or outstanding piece of sports writing and examines how the writer crafted their story. This is a weekly show, and the series so far has featured documentaries on The Miracle of Castel di Sangro and Andrea Pirlo's autobiography, I Think, Therefore I Play. There's also interviews with writers like Henry Winter, Simon Cooper, Andy Mitten, and David Goldblatt. Here's Raf Honigstein with his brilliant piece focusing on Erling Haaland signing for Borussia Dortmund instead of fill in the blank, but we know it's Manchester United.
A transfer story is essentially as a happy story. Three parties got what they wanted. Everyone thought that they had done great work and had got a great deal out of it. Dortmund were proud of their achievement of getting this guy. Haaland, I think, was really, really happy with having made this decision. I think the agent obviously wanted to show that why this was the right decision and why others were wrong, to sort of dismiss the reasons why they went, etc. So as much as it is a detective work, it's not solving a murder case. You are dealing with something that is actually quite positive and that people are, to an extent, quite happy to talk about.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Alcantara, you've painted such a picture of the man, and there aren't many football clubs or national sides that I've ever heard of, investigated, been with, where the manager, there's always two or three around the manager who are his Praetorian guard, but that one footballer might speak before the manager or take care of the administration openly, quietly in the dressing room when the manager's not there, packed it, yeah, but I've never heard of what you've described there, and that Heinkes is a man who, latterly they called him Osram because he went red when he lost his temper, and he could lose his temper, and he was a very direct-spoken man. He was Athletic Bilbao, he was the guy who said, you know, we're a little Athletic, we're a little Volkswagen, and we're competing with Ferraris and Maseratis around Europe because we can only sign Basques. He's very direct indeed, and a guy who took Bayern to the treble, but he was your coach at the time. Why do you think, or what was it about his personality, irrespective of the fact that Alcantara was a majestic specimen of a man, he was about your size and athleticism, sort of, and an extraordinary footballer bringing the ball out, competitive, a winner. What was it about Heinkes that allowed that sharing of power? And what was Heinkes like as a coach for you?
He was very strict, Graham. You know, everything was a visual for Heinkes. You used to walk in the corridor and you would see your weight on the wall. Weighed every day. Never had a Sunday off. I don't remember having a Sunday off at Bayern Munich in my life. When players complain about, oh, we're training again. I'm like, it doesn't matter where we were on a Saturday. Even if we flew back in the Sunday morning, we went straight to the training ground to train. So everything was about that for him. I think he was revered anyway because all the German boys knew how good a football player he was. You know, he's, you know, played for the national team, et cetera, et cetera, and carried a lot of weight behind him. And he might have changed a little bit, well, maybe not actually, when he was at Bilbao and then Real Madrid, of course, where he won the Champions League, came back to Bayern, won the Champions League again when they were at... and in fact, he had me in and around the team that little trip, the one against Dortmund. I was literally with the team and him and, you know, everybody. It was fantastic. The game was obviously in London. The game was at Wembley. And he was always good to me, but he was very strict. He was quite kept everybody arm's length a little bit. I don't think you could get too close. I don't think you got to the inner sanctum if you were a football player with Jupp Heynckes. But he is loved by Bayern, and the job he did there was brilliant. Or he certainly wouldn't have come back.
He was a striker like you. He's definitely shaped in you. He was a different kind of footballer. He was a striker. In that organisation, who'd have had the... So was Uli Hoeneß, which maybe some people listening now would forget. Who'd have had the biggest voice? Or whoever told you, well, listen, Alan, this is the first time we saw you. Rummenigge was more business and direction of the club. Uli, business, but also a voice in the football and a fan, like almost an ultra. And then Jupp, who'd have had the louder voice about this guy, Alan McInally, we've got to have him?
I would think Uli, probably, until Jupp had obviously seen me play a couple of times and then obviously come and... No, he physically came to watch me play. You know, I think he still had the bigger voice in terms of who he wanted to come in. It was difficult when I still remember myself sitting in the whatever hotel conference room we'd be sitting in for the team meeting, and they're speaking German. You know, I'm looking at the pictures on the wall thinking, I wonder if that was here last season when another football club was in here. You know what I mean? And then Alan would be like, surely go, sorry, I'm listening. But like, because my German wasn't that good at the time. And then one of the masseuses, to be fair, his English was very good. And Hunes was good as well. And they would sit with me afterwards and just say, look, this is how we're going to play. So we're going to play. This is the formation. You're marking. You're doing this with the ball, without the ball, etc., etc. And they always used to talk about that. And it's something I say quite a lot on television now. Football's a brilliant game, but there's definitely two sides to the game. Having the ball and not having the ball. And not having the ball sometimes can be every bit as important, if not more important, when we don't have the ball. Now, you're talking about a football team that used to majoritively have the majority of the ball with Bayern Munich. But even they were like, hey, if we don't have the ball, there's a job to be done here, because the first thing we want to do is get it back. And I was like, well, that makes sense. Teeny wee thing, stupid wee thing. Bayern Munich, big thing. So stuff like that, Heynckes was certainly strong, but strong on making sure I knew what my job was. And to be fair to you, Heynckes, and I would love you to ask him this to see if I was telling a lie. I used to have a massage from a guy called Atze Gebhardt, who's just a diamond guy, one of the masseuses. And I would go about 8:30 and we'd put on Monty Python stupid things on the TV and all that. You know, like the 100 metres dash for people without that, you know, where they were going. And I'd tell the story. We didn't have it on the TV. We'd just talk about it, rather. And Atze and I would be laughing uncontrollably and just about things. But every Friday night, Jupp Heynckes would come in to where he knew I was getting a massage, asked me how I was, speaking in German and blah, blah, blah. And I could see Axie's stupidity change when the gaffer came in, because he would kind of backstreet, start giving a bit of that. How's that on your wrist, Al? Is that okay? And every single time I had a massage on a Friday night, your pinky would come in and make sure I was all right. Every time, for the whole length of time I was a Bayern Munich player.
The club of
and
detail.
When I look back now, I think of that was kind.
Two guys can't escape our focus because, you know, Uli Hoeneß, injured young, won the World Cup in 1974. His plane came down and he walked away. Not a lot of people walk away from plane crashes. He did. His exuberance about I know best led him to get the jail because he didn't think rules applied to him. But there are very few ex-footballers in the history of our sport who've led and built a club like he did. And people forget that in the 40s and 50s, and even in the early 60s, just as Uli was coming to the youth system, Bayern wasn't a great club. The greatness has come late 60s and thereafter forever. And his name, not everybody likes him. And we were laughing because we both know it, but like, as a director of Bayern, he's been in punch-ups in director's box because it's as if he's got a wee bit of Scottish blood in him. To what degree did you get an insight into the man?
I love Uli Hoeneß. I was genuinely sad about the jail thing. I remember somebody said to me, said, Uli's in Gefängnis. And I was like, Gefängnis? What is that? He went, Uli's in jail. I was like, what? Well, I was shocked. But I'll tell you three stories. Says to me, then, you speak to me in German and I'll speak to you in English. I was like, okay. He said, if you get 10 headed goals, I'll give you 100,000 Deutschmarks. I was like, okay. Radmila Mihailovic and I went to a nightclub on Thursday night. And then the Saturday morning in the lift, he pointed to me and he said, don't do that again. I was like, don't do what? He went, you were out Thursday night. I was like, how in God's name did you know? But of course, he is Mr. Munich. That's how he knows. He said to me, come on, you're coming for lunch. And I was like, oh, brilliant. I said, where are we going? He went, you're coming to the house. Meet my family, my wife, etc., etc. And I was like, oh, brilliant. And I don't have anything here, actually. I wish I'd. And he went, there you go. Hold that, the World Cup.
Ah, beautiful, man. Yeah.
I was like, seriously? I got to play in at three games in straight home, but I'm now holding the German World Cup. I was like, I can't really top that, really. It's impossible. But he loved the way I tried and gave my best. He's just a legend of a man at Bayern. And for me, he was fantastic. And there's one genuine point I should say. My career finished when I was 30 years old from an injury. I was so unlucky. You know, and I'm expecting to be at Bayern for 10 years. He looked after me. I was probably lucky that my career finished at the very top level with someone like Uli Hoeneß at the helm, because he looked after me to make sure I was okay.
So human decency in a sport where, as much as we love our sport, the industry you excelled in can be quite cold. It can be full of deceit too. And you're contrasting the fact that he was what, human and decent, and saw somebody he liked who'd been hit by the worst thing that happened to a footballer, which is a career-ending injury, and he stood up for you.
Absolutely, for sure. And even now, I can see him now. If I walk into his office, if I go back to Sabinerstrasse in Munich where the training ground is, and I walk into his office, I can see him sit back there and go, Mr. McInerney. I can see him do it. He does all the things like, Mr. McInerney. What? Tell me what's... You know, and he's... You know, I just have a genuine affection for the man. And obviously still for the football club, because like I said, who'd have thought that a wee boy for Ayr would end up at Bayern Munich?
Who'd have thought that Hansi Flick would have ended up being the second Bayern Munich manager to win a treble? Maybe you had some inkling then. I mean, for those who've forgotten, he takes over from Kovac in the middle of last season at a time when, geez, Eintracht Frankfurt come up again. Eintracht Frankfurt have pumped Bayern, put five past them, and they're a rabble. Kovac is unsympathetic. The players don't like his training. He was an ex-central defender at Bayern and successful, but for whatever reason, they just look ragged. And by the end of the season, they've Flick's won them everything. What is it about Hansi Flick you can tell us that lifts our understanding of the guy that's made Bayern so successful?
Yeah, he's quite a quiet guy. You know, he wasn't the loudest in the dressing room by any manner of means. I used to play backgammon with Hansi all the time. We'd sit on the balcony and play backgammon. I'm sure he still owes me money. He must have a few quid by now. Studious in terms of football, would I have said he'd be? Yeah, probably. I'd probably have thought he'd go down the manager route. You remember he was the assistant manager when they won the World Cup in Brazil.
Yeah.
When Joachim Löw was the manager. So, you know, he's learning from the top place. He then took a bit of a back seat and went into the sort of DFB. And then Bayern came calling, and it was almost a no-brainer for Hansi to go and take it. I think he's pretty matter of a fact. But I do think the influence he's had on Thomas Müller that Kovac didn't have has helped the whole shooting match at Bayern as well. Because he's a kind of, not an Uli Hoeneß figure, but he's that important to Bayern Munich. He's got that,
yes,
that Bavarian stamp on the forehead. He's a Bayerish lad. You know, he likes a beer. He speaks Bayerish. He plays brilliant. He gives everything he's got. And I think with the players that he's obviously injected into the football team, it's just been a time for Hansi Flick to switch the whole thing, turn Bayern round, and make them European champions. And he thoroughly deserves it. He's done a brilliant job. And by the way, if you get to meet him, Graham, he's quite quiet. You know, he's not brash in any way. And he's quite profound. And maybe that's one of the reasons why he's done so well in terms of being a study of football, the way he wants to play and get players in to play him in a particular position and make them as good as they possibly can be.
Bet365, the last one, and you mentioned the World Cup and that you're playing it. Describe the feelings and emotions of walking out to represent your country, the mighty Scotland, in a World Cup fixture.
I can't. There is no words. You're as good a wordsmith as I know. You are in your commentary. You are in your written press. I don't know. I thought about my grandfather, my dad. I thought about the fans. I thought about people in a pub in Inverurie. It's hard to comprehend. There was a huge. I didn't feel huge pressure. I certainly felt huge disappointment because the game against Costa Rica. I mean, you've got myself and Maurice Johnston and Roy Aitken and Alec McLeish and Willie Miller and Jim Bett and Richard Gough, and none of us can score a goal. None of us. We got beat 1-0. We then beat Sweden 2-1 and get beat by Brazil 1-0. We go home after three games. And Roxburgh, Andy Roxburgh, who was the manager, and Craig Brown, the assistant manager, must still to this day be thinking, how in God's name did we not get to go through the group with Brazil? And if there's one game I would change, and I mean only one, you lose football matches, you can be lucky, you can be a little unlucky. There was only one game in my entire career I would change, and it's a game against Costa Rica. And it wasn't because we were flippant or arrogant or thought we were going to win. We could have played till now and not scored. Can you imagine the amount of people that were thinking, oh, brilliant, and we know what the Tartan Army's like, and you know, and you could suck the ball into the net at times, and it just wasn't going to be. But it was just the best feeling ever to hear. I can't, if you played the bagpipes now, I'd start crying. There, that's how it is to play for Scotland. If you play for Scotland, you hear the bagpipes, I'm out of here. Can't happen.
Beautiful, I'll go in a minute if you don't. I'm getting all teary and all. The last one is, I wish I was ending on a different note, but whenever I've listened to you on television, and I'm lucky enough to have seen you play, and I know that you've got a massive enthusiasm for life and that you've enjoyed your life subsequent to football, and you've enriched our lives, those who haven't played football, because of the way that you communicate the thing that you did best in life. You said that you had a lovely spell with TB at Kilmarnock coaching. Whether it was coaching, doing the Ole Hoeneß side of football, whether it might be player selection in this director of football role, to what degree, notwithstanding the fact that you've had a rich, happy life that's kept you young and vital and popular subsequent to your playing career, to what degree do you think, have I invested all my talents? Could I have thrived back right inside the football world? Or zero regrets?
No, lots of regrets that I'm not a coach or a manager. Or I did all my coaching badges right away as soon as I got injured. I went with Roxburgh and everybody and down to Inverclyde, and you had Mourinho. Everybody was coming at the time we do the coaching badges. I got everything. I got an A. Then I did an A+. Nobody phoned Alan McAnally to say, he must have some experience. We'll give him a chance to be a coach or a manager. I ended up being in television very, very quickly. And obviously with my knowledge in the football and doing my coaching badges, I was quite confident in speaking about the way teams played, the way I would like them to play, and lucky to keep my job, and lucky to watch football and try and paint a picture every game I'm at. I'd be as excited as I'd normally get. Because unless I'm watching a really bad game, people are like, oh, big man's in a bad mood today, like a shot on target. But I can make Preston against Millwall sound like a European Cup final and thoroughly enjoy it as long as I've got a wee five-a-side bet and speak to Jeff down the line and have the relationship with Jeff Stirling that I do have on television.
Alan, no bullshit, no moonshine. That's just been epic, absolutely epic and beautiful. Thank you for being so generous. Go and play your socks off. Bring the handicap down before the winter greens are in there. And thank you very much indeed. Thank you for listening to The Big Interview. It's produced by me, which sounds egotistical, but it's also true, Graham Hunter, and Backpage. Our music is by Beer Jacket, who else? Editing by Charlie McGarry. Thank you to our hosts at Acast and our loyal sponsors at Bet365. We're also supported by our socios. Find out how to become a socio, how to support us at patreon.com/GrahamHunter. Here endeth the lesson.